Hello and welcome to yet another edition of Tea with Nettie. My guest today is conductor Riccardo Minasi, who is currently conducting at Glyndebourne. We're doing Così fan tutti, and it is absolutely fantastically entertaining working with him. I mean, not only is he a superb musician with a wonderful technique, and he can show us what he wants just by sort of dancing or twirling or raising an eyebrow, but he's actually very, very funny. He's got a great sense of humour, and I don't think I've ever seen the whole orchestra so incredibly cheerful throughout the whole show. This is really wonderful. As you will hear, there are a lot of very droll moments in this conversation, and I'm sorry I laughed rather too much. I hope it won't deafen you.
Tea with Nettie.
Well, hello, Riccardo, and thank you so much for agreeing to talk to me here on a day of a performance at Glyndebourne of Così.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
And there's so many things I want to ask you, but maybe we could start from the beginning and your childhood and where music came into your life, and classical music in particular.
Yeah, I started music because of my father that was working in the railway state company. No, sorry, this is a joke. I started music because of my mom, because she was an opera singer. Mm-hmm. Actually, she stopped when I was 3 years old, so I don't have memories of her singing, but yeah, she was a professional singer. Mm-hmm. And my father, as I said, yes, he was working in a railway company, so he was totally out from the music. He didn't know anything about it. But yeah, so somehow I started with the Suzuki method. You know, my mom, she's Japanese.
Yes.
So I started, even if I didn't want to, when I was 3 years old. Can you imagine?
Did she come to all the classes? Did she come to the classes?
Yeah, you know,
with you?
At the beginning, the Suzuki method, it works that the teacher, when you have kids of such a young, early age, the teacher is coming at home, is teaching to the parents, and the parents are teaching to the kids. Mm. So the first experiences were like that, with my mom teaching me violin. I didn't want at all, you know, in Rome. I was thinking only about football until pretty recently, actually. then at a certain moment.
What, like yesterday?
Yes, yeah, like before yesterday, yeah. And then, step by step, even if I didn't want to, when I was 9, 10 years old, I got interested about it. It was something that also was doing pretty well at the time for my age. And I was lucky enough to have a friend of mine, Richard Gueli. He's a guy from South Africa.
Yeah.
He moved to Italy just that year when we were 10 years old. And he was playing really much better than me. So we had not a competition, because we are such a close friends. He was really my buddy, you know. Mm. And we're talking about everything. But he came from a family that had a really deep interest about music. His father was a collector of recordings, LPs, etc. He had a huge collection of LPs. Uh-huh. So we spent a lot of time at home in his apartment listening to music, etc., etc. And playing together, you know, and doing all the possible duets, Stamitz and the double concerto by Bach, etc., things like that. And we were sharing so many good experiences. And even one that I was mentioning the other day to Lisa Beznosiuk, your first mm-hmm. flute.
Yeah.
We were 10 years old, and we went to the Auditorium San Leone Magno in Rome.
Yes.
To listen to the English concert with Trevor Pinnock. It was my first concert I ever heard with an early music ensemble. I had no clue, no idea what an early music ensemble was. We heard about this original instrument. What is an original instrument? What does it mean? No? So we went, you know, when you're a child. You know.
What year would that have been?
That was the end of the 80s. So we went there and Lisa was playing at that concert.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Brandenburg Five, I suppose.
No, she was playing La Notte. By Vivaldi,
okay.
And so we went there, and I remember they started, and we were watching each other like, "What is this? What is this sound?" Mm. You know, this zzz quality that has this.
Yes.
But I remember we had almost an heart attack. We never heard that this spacious, this transparent, and somehow. Gutty sound, you know,
yes.
Coming really from
visceral.
Visceral was less edulcorated, was a little bit more direct, with a very direct impact. I remember the shock we had at this concert, and so the other day I was talking with Elisa. I said I must tell you this story because I was so happy also to meet Alison Berry actually the other day because as I told you then afterwards I think 1 or 2 weeks after this concert I bought a recording of the Trio Sonatas by Corelli with Tom Koopman with Monica Haggett, Japter Linden and Alison Berry is the second violin. And I consumed this recording. I remember I was listening continuously to this recording. Yeah.
So you were really struck. It was an instant sort of fascination with that sound.
Absolutely, absolutely. Mm. And I remember, for some reason, also doing this project with you guys is somehow is I don't know if you have this this way to say we use in Italy like closing the circle somehow.
Yes, we say come full circle.
Yeah, exactly. Because my early ages about early music fascination and interest was really a lot British orientated somehow because the recordings, you know,
funny?
Archive recordings, Gardiner of course, and Pinnock, and then Oakwood, etc., etc. I was listening a lot of recordings of Roger Norrington, of course, and etc., etc. And coming here and looking in the orchestra and seeing some of those key figures that I...
must have been really funny.
Yes, it was.
Looking a lot older now, but still
seeing. No, it's not that. It's,
but the funny thing is, when we started this orchestra in 1986, one of the things we wanted to do was to be able to invite conductors and directors from Europe and from elsewhere, because most of our Baroque experience, apart from with Tom Koopman, had been with British musicians. I was quite an admirer of the orchestra of the 18th century with Franz Bruggen, and it was wonderful to have him over. And we had Gustav Leonhardt, who came over and also had an extremely different way of asking us to play.
Yeah.
And then all that fed back in, because we all played in all the British groups anyway. There weren't so many Baroque people, so all that we got from people like Franz Bruggen and Leonhardt and Sigiswald Kuijken then fed back into our playing.
Then
we went back to John Elliott Gardner and Trevor Pinnock, with this added dimension. So that was quite funny, really.
Yes. I played with Gustav Leonhardt.
Did you?
Yes. Long time ago when I was a student in Basel with Chiara Banchini.
Really? Oh, yes.
Was actually were the first concerts with the recently funded group called La Cetra that it exists now, no?
Yeah.
Where at the time was like a sort of laboratory coming out from the students of Chiara and the students of the Scuola Cantorum Basilensis. And they invited Leonhardt for a couple of concerts, if I'm not wrong. And I remember I was back sitting in the second violins. We were two Italians. We were playing
Italians.
Brava, you understood. Like Satana and Nosferatu. And I remember one day, Gustav Leonhardt watched us and said, he used just the gestures.
Yes. Now,
he looked at us and said, don't play like play like
really?
I don't know if he's passing through the mic with this gesture. No? I went, okay, maestro, okay, yes. Where are you from? From Italy. Ah, yes, I see. It was a very unusual program for him because we did Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach.
Oh, yes.
That was not a repertoire that he did so often, no?
No.
But yet, this approach, you know, Carl Philipp Emanuel for me is, yeah, the crazy horse, no? Among yes. the son of Johann Sebastian, yeah. together with Wilhelm Friedman. So I had already this instinct, okay, but this is music of disruption of the form. This is music, it's Sturm und Drang, it's a baby Beethoven inside. Come on, we have to we crush the system, etc. Yeah, give it. And then Leonard had another concept to complete. We're all sorry, maestro, we are going to complete in a different way. Yeah, yeah. A great musician, my gosh. Yeah.
He is a great musician.
Incredible.
After this initial sort of, was it a conversion or was it oh my goodness, this is wonderful, how can I do it and find out more? What did you do together, you and Richard, your friend? Did you any efforts to do
yes,
it yourself?
Yes, of course. We were, of course, studying in the conservatory in Rome. We were doing a classical, standard course of studies of modern violin, how you can call it. But at the same time, we were trying to make our experiments, you know, holding the bow a little bit higher.
Yes, of course, well.
Imitating head movements of a certain player that we saw. Being more free, more naive, more new age. At the time, close to the Stazione Termini in Rome, there were a music instrument shop called Fredi that was on an heritage of an old violin maker in Rome that made an incredible instrument, Rodolfo Fredi. And the owners of this shop, they were ordering many violins from China. You know those fabric violins beginners, stuff
of
like
course,
that.
Yes.
And those violins were coming to Europe with gut strings, mostly harp strings, you know,
right.
with different colors.
Yes.
Red, blue,
yes.
green, and blue, and black. And what they were doing in this shop, they were just removing the strings, putting them in the garbage and replacing them with, I don't know, standard dominant metal strings. So we were there with Richard collecting all of those terrible strings, and trying to make our first experiment, you know? That was, our first attempt to try to imitate what we were listening in the recording. Another key figure was the recording of Simon Standage. Remember, because the Bach violin concertos. Because
yes.
you know, in the conservatory, everyone was listening to David and Igor.
Yes,
so was the nothing to say against them. Per l'amor del cielo,
very
fantastic players. I mean, we are talking about two gods of the violin, and but with a completely different culture about the sound, about everything. And then suddenly this album of the violin concertos by Bach with Simon Stange came out, and then we put this LP, I remember, again.
Yes.
Mouth open, tongue outside, what is this?
Did you know anybody else who was interested as you were, or were you two?
No. Actually, we were looked as, people from another
crazy.
Planet. Come on, what are you doing? They are playing badly, out of tune, with squeaky sounds. What is this? Even my mom, when I was at home trying to do my first attempt, she came because she had this... this idea in the head that I had to be, Gidon Kremer, no? She was really focused on that. Oh, you must be, And I was there and doing my first, meow, meow. And she was coming in the room. What are you doing? What is this? So having also this pressure, I was keeping always a foot into the modern world. Early world and modern world.
Yes,
I was trying to do both, yeah.
And did you spend a lot of time with Richard's family as well as with Richard? Because it was
yes, with the father. With the father, yes. The father actually had a very important impact on me. There were several key figures at the time. I was trained, let's say, I was lucky enough to meet and to study with several members of I Musici di Roma at the time.
Really?
Yeah. Do you remember them?
Yes,
yeah?
Of course.
But at the time, recording. I mean, they were fantastic.
Yes.
We are talking, you know, the golden age of this people, let's say, if you, in my opinion, still now, their recordings of the 60s. Are still impressive,
yes.
I have to say. Okay, we can discuss about the tempi, but they were never vulgar. They were like, you know, a column of a Greek structure.
Yes.
Very classy playing, super in tune, with a culture of the sound, of the phrasing, the legato. I remember my maestro, Paolo Centurioni, there. Legato! Mario Centurione is his brother, the cellist. Legato! It's a very... insisting about, you know, things that I found myself nowadays are lacking in the formation of the new musicians. So I had this contact with between this they say old school and those strange sounds coming from elsewhere.
Yes.
So I'm trying to combine these two worlds. It was an interesting. Interesting process. And the father of Richard, I remember, he was there talking about, you know, the virtuosic violin playing, etc., but also considering and taking account the new experiences, the pioneers. That, of course, this movement started already 30, 40 years before, but we had no clue about it.
No. And alongside this, did you ever learn a keyboard instrument, or was it just the violin?
No, I studied piano, of course. At the time in the conservatory in Rome, now the system of teaching music changed radically in Italy. I don't know why they changed completely. I mean, I know why, but to avoid to get too much into politics, let's avoid this topic. And... the formation of every student, whatever you were playing, a flute or a bassoon or a violin, was, you had to follow a course of piano lessons.
Yeah.
I had a very nice piano teacher. The brother of the ex-major of the city of Rome, Argan. I remember, the first years of study of piano, what you play, the Clementi sonatinas,
yes.
You know, your first, some Beethoven,
Bach,
some Haydn,
yes.
Some Bach, exactly, and the Microcosmos by Bartok.
He
came with those Microcosmos,
fantastic.
And that was a big discovery for me. And you remember, I was there and started to think about the touch on the piano. And that was ridiculous because, you know, I was there like tong, tang, tong, 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 tang, tong, tong. Everyone was playing like that in the class. And was trying to create nice sound in the piano. And I remember Argan looking at me and say, oh, that's beautiful what you are doing. I mean, there were two parts, very
yes.
simple melody, nothing
yes.
Nothing virtuosistic, of course, even if the last Microcosmos are pretty complex. But, you know, the first, I don't know, second, third book, and I don't remember. And it was really, oh, look, that's very musical. And so it was feeding me with tips. He said, but you know, maybe you should put the hands in that way.
Mm-hmm.
So he was taking care a little bit of things that normally you, for a beginner, you spend time with, no?
But he recognized something
yes.
new that was really unusual and musical.
Yeah, I think so. Not to auto-celebrate myself, but I remember in that class, with kids of 11, 12 years old, I was the only one that maybe was not practicing and I was not as brilliant as others, but I was taking care of those small details. And he really appreciated that, I remember.
The fact you've remembered that, you were obviously very encouraged by that.
I was encouraged because I thought, okay, I'm doing something creative that is not just playing the right note in the right moment with a metronome. No, it's something else
yes.
that is talking to my soul. Yeah. And because also, you know, coming back at home, I had the tiger mother saying, oh, have you did your Sevchik, your Shradik this morning? Not really. Okay, go. You know, so it was something more creative next to the Kreutzer etude. You know? So that was very important. Another key figure was Aldo Peverini, was my solfeggio teacher. And because basically, if I'm conducting now, I have to say, than 99% of the things I learned from this solfeggio teacher. At the time, he was teaching us the gesture that you have when you study conducting. He said, "Where is your two? Where is the second bit? It's not clear. No, you need a point." He was really teaching conducting. Fantastic. With the movement of the hands. Yeah. No, it's not clear. What is this farfalla? This come si dice farfalla? This butterfly hands. What is butterfly hands? What are you? Are you massaging the air? No, precise. One, two, three. He had to remember a coin of 5 Swiss franc. You know the 5 Swiss franc coin, a very big one on the table. Stonk, stonk, stonk. In tempo, in tempo. Caprone, he was calling me Caprone, big goat. Caprone, in tempo, what is the butterfly hand? Precise, 1, 2, 3, 4, no, 1, 3, 3, 4, precise, precise. And he was very strict and at the time I was terrified by him.
Well, I have to say,
it was really, but you know, I think somehow having to deal with some rudeness sometimes can help, I have to say. Mm. Also, my second teacher, Alfredo Fiorentini, a great violinist, He was playing in an incredible way. Mm-hmm. And he was a student of André Gettler in Brussels.
Yes.
A student of Isaïe. And he was a super virtuoso. He was there with his violin always in his hand, in his lesson, with his scroll next to mine, watching with his incredible strong eyes into mine. And he was studying every week. He was studying every week all the road, the Fiorillo, Caprice, you know, that we're taking at the lesson. And say, no, look, the fingerings, look, what is this hand? Like that, tock, tack, tick. It was incredible. With his cigar always. He had a cigar always between the first two fingers. No, was the time where smoking was.
Of course, yes. And he used the violin as an ashtray, I suppose, did he? Into the
F-holes. Almost. I remember one day a big bunch of ash just collapsed on the instrument. Like,
really?
He just shake the violin a little bit, choo 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 choo, and that's it.
And presumably you didn't dare tell him about your experiments on the gut strings, did you?
I told him one day. And I tell you another story that this is funny because he was against this movement, a priori. Well, he's coming from another generation, you know. And he was a Jewish violinist coming from a really, you know, I would say Belgian-oriented school with a certain way to play, with very incredible and various way to use the bow that maybe the Russian school had not with such
a small detail speaking way.
He was asking us to do the alphabet.
Oh yes,
with the pronunciation, with the consonant. This is a k or a t. I can't hear the difference, you know, stuff like I don't see so much around. And he was a priori against this movement, but then one day he gave me a cassette of the sonatas and partitas recorded by Thomas Zettmeyer.
Oh.
Do you remember this recording?
No, I never heard his recording of that.
It's fantastic. He was very young. He was a baby, but, you know, it was the time that in Vienna he got in contact with Nicolas Ornoncourt already, et cetera, et cetera, because we were hearing, I don't know, sharing Nathan Milstein recording of the Sonata and Partita that are fantastic, fantastic recordings. I mean, Nathan Milstein is really in my heart, I have to say. But then this Thomas Zettmeyer came out. I said, what is this? And then, of course, then... the process was Sigis Valkoiken, etc., etc., and Lucy Van Dahl, etc., etc. But Lucy Van Dahl actually came out when I was already out from the school. But I remember, for sure, there is Sigis Valkoiken recording was really something out from the world.
And also with this speaking,
of course, very various ways of. Also to put the chords together.
Yes.
No, no. Chua, chua, chua. This is that. Or chiu, chiu, even, no? And then we have also to reconsider also this chiu. Or a chuiu also. There's also the other way, right? I never spin in the chiui, actually. That is the chiui? No.
It's so interesting hearing about your beginnings on the violin, and presumably the, I don't know why I keep saying presumably, it's a very British word, but you were doing all this repertoire with your teacher, but your heart maybe was sort of more attracted to, rather than the virtuoso stuff, but maybe you were Bach and Mozart.
Yeah,
and
chamber music for sure, and yes.
Chamber
yes.
music. Were you playing any chamber music
yes,
at that
yes.
time?
Yes, yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, I started very early. When I was 10, I had some friends of mine, Luca Proietti, a pianist, a double bass player, Roberto Baseggio, a cellist, and other guys, and we formed a group in a church in Rome, the church of San Biagio dei Materazzari, Santa Cecilia in Campo Marzio, in the center of Rome. Is one of the best corners that you can imagine in Rome. Okay. Is in on a small street, Vicolo di San Biagio, where Caravaggio had apparently his workshop. And yeah, it's a wonderful church, and had an organ, an organ of the early 19th century. Mm-hmm. And we started to play during the masses.
Yeah. Was that your idea?
Yes, and we were starting, you know, I was coming, look, I have this recording with Alison Barry of the trio sonatas by Corelli. We should play the same trio sonata by Corelli, now with the organ. We had a very nice organ. It's a wonderful instrument. Yeah. Needs a restoration, but yes, it's still working very well. I went to visit the nuns recently. So I was doing, you know, my school in the center of Rome and going in the conservatory in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. And during lunch break, we were meeting every day there. Playing, longer lunch break, maybe we're starting the lesson, I don't know, 3-4 o'clock in the afternoon, something like that. So we had 2-3 hours to make experiments. I played my first Bach with a Jacques Gottin Allenland, the cantata number 51, with a trumpet student that had the trumpet in B flat. He was trying. He made the transcription for trumpet in C. He was like, but you know, when you are 11, you don't know the things. It was like, it's so hard. It was horrible. And trying things like that. And then coming back to the lesson with the maestro, I said, what you did to your sound? Where is the sustained sound? I said, no, maestro, because I was trying to imitate those guys from England. You know?
and he said, why?
No, actually, one day he confessed me, you know, it's a sort of malediction, like the Tutankhamun malediction I'm living. Because I had a student exactly like you when I was teaching in the conservatory in Perugia. It was Enrico Gatti. So that day I discovered that Enrico Gatti was studying modern violin with the same teacher I had.
Oh, how interesting.
And later on so I met funny. Enrico Gatti and told him, but you know, I'm a student of Alfredo. Oh, really? Yes.
That's so funny. We have someone like that in London, David Takeno. I don't know if you've heard of
him.
Yes,
of course. Yeah.
And he, whether by accident or design, has produced quite a few people, like Rachel Podger and Pablo Besnosiuk.
Yeah, he was a teacher of all of them. Yeah,
yes,
of course.
All of them. Yeah. Yes. Oh, that's so funny. And but that enterprise of starting that group that played in the church, that would have stood you in good stead for when you came to found your own early music groups.
Yeah, of course. I still remember the day I realized during, I think, a mass, we were playing, I don't know, during the offertorium or something like that, that I realized that I was able to play my own part and listening to the others. I remember that, and I was, I think, 10, 11, 12 years old, maybe, I don't know. And I realized, oh, look, and it's so good that I can hear the others and trying to adapt my way of playing following the others. That, I think, was the... how do you say, the PE, the gym, the preparation for what later I did.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, let's jump forward a little bit Il Pomodoro. How did that come about?
Yeah, Il Pomodoro came up. It was an idea together with Giulio D'Alessio. It was the... not a friend, but somebody that I knew since a long time, because we were playing together with Elima of Gabriel Garrido. We met each other over there. And then he was, violinist, player in the group of Alan Curtis for many years. Mm-hmm. And he was at a certain moment also the producer of the group of Alan Curtis. And I would say now I can say that the Pomodoro started on a bad moon day because at a certain moment he was... Yeah, he had his reason to convert the financial support of the group of Alan Curtis into a new group, Il Pomodoro. I can say that I'm trying in my in everyday life to be, say, honest and talk frankly with people. And yes. I found it a little bit awkward, this thing.
Yes.
Also using the same musicians, also because I had always a big respect for Alan Curtis, even if I never played with him.
Yes.
But I knew, of course, the name. I knew that was a key figure, especially for the development of the early music movement everywhere, but especially in Italy. He did so much. And if you think that he was the first arpeggiologist playing Louis Couperin, he was an incredible scholar for the diffusion of the music by Rameau and all he did with the madrigals, with the Gesualdo, with Monteverdi music, etc. I mean, it's... It's a heritage. It's we have to pay a lot to him, and but somehow Giulio talked with him, and Alan accepted the situation. He said, "Okay." Also, because it was a moment where his group was basically stalked because he had not so much energy about it.
Okay.
So he gave me a couple of concerts of Il Complesso Barocco.
Really?
He couldn't do a tour. He said, okay, let's give this to Minasi, even if I never played with him.
Wow.
And then one day he invited, we had a concert in Bilbao, if I'm not wrong. I was in Spain, I think, yes. Or San Sebastián, I don't remember, in the Basque area. Mm-hmm. And, with the Stabat Mater by Pergolesi.
Mm-hmm.
I was a concertmaster. It was the only time I played with him.
Mm-hmm.
And I found an incredible musician. Okay, he was not, let's say, a properly trained conductor. So maybe people was maybe complaining about the fact that he was not extremely clear with his hands. But the thoughts, everything when he was opening his mouth was just to say something that was a key point.
Yes.
Something that you could just make treasure of. And it was so inspiring. I learned so much. And then, of course, he was delegating to the principals the responsibility to get the group together.
Yes.
But it is fine. This is fine. He was there with his musical thought. With and I have to say, recently I recorded the Stabat Mater Pergolesi, and I have to say, there's a lot of what I learned from Alan about this piece. Alan was a person with such a wide culture about everything, and he really knew so much about the Napoli of the 18th century. He was transmitting to his musicians all those topics that were a vital part of his inspiration, his approach about this music. We decided to form this group. And with basically the half of the group with musicians of Il Complesso Barocco, and without any real expectation, because you know it was the time where baroque groups from Italy were starting every week like mushrooms. Really. So we had no expectation. Okay, we formed again another baroque group. Okay, whatever. And after. Few months, I have to say, after 10 months, if I don't remember wrongly, we start to have so many invitations that we couldn't almost manage the amount of work we had. It was like a rain of requests.
And was that within Italy or was it elsewhere in Europe?
Everywhere. No, actually in Italy the activity of Pomodoro was never took place so much.
Mm-hmm.
I don't perform so much in Italy. Mm. Actually, I did my debut as a conductor in Italy in last November.
Really?
I never conducted an Italian orchestra before last November.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah. Oh. And it's so what happened? We start to have invitation, recordings, contracts with important labels. And no, just that was It was really, believe me, totally unexpected. It just came out from... Yeah, I was, you could say, putting a lot of effort on the quality.
Yes.
With, you know, having this background we were talking about before, you know, with those teachers that were the sound, legato, caprone. So I was trying to combine somehow the... Also because before I was lucky enough when I was pretty young, in 1997, I started to play with Il Giardino Armonico.
Group,
yes. Okay. For many years I was like, I don't know, the Prezzemolo, the Purcell, everywhere in all the Italian Baroque groups. I did all
yes.
of them.
Yes.
Accademia Bizantina, Giardino Armonico, Cicci, Ciocio, I played with everybody.
Yes.
And Il Giardino Armonico when I start to play with them, was not a chamber music group or a chamber orchestra. It was like a laboratory of experiments.
Okay.
With the most visionary people I ever met in my life, I have to say. And that left a big imprinting in my experience. I was there, I was looking around, I said, but those guys are completely crazy.
Yes.
I mean, the most crazy idea anyone was coming with key figures. I mean, at the time, you know, Enrico Nofri was playing there, Paolo Beschi, Giovanni Antonini, of course, Luca Pianca, the lute player. There were plenty of very prepared musicians, and everyone was coming with the most pioneeristic and crazy idea about playing in the most crazy way, and no one was complaining, and no one was cynical about it. We said, okay, I don't know if it works if we put our instruments on our head, but let's try. Why not was like a key word. So I was trying with the Pomodoro to recreate more or less the same entourage I was encountering in the Giardino Armonico, but I was unable to find the right people, probably. And I was hoping that delegating a responsibility to some of the figures, some of them were my students, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, the biggest part of the violin section were my students. I was teaching for 7 years in the Conservatory in Palermo.
Really? And you're still very young then, I suppose.
I was the youngest teacher in the conservatories in Italy at the time when I started.
Okay.
And I had several students of mine, and I was telling them sometimes, I was very disappointed. I said, come on, can you believe we are the Italian group, even if at a certain moment the base of the group moved to Switzerland, but we are the Italian group that is working the most now.
Yeah.
We have more concerts than anyone else. And we are here complaining, asking for for more comfort. Let's get more involved. Let's have a bigger participation. Let's try to get to our certain. We must have a target, no? We must guarantee a certain result, despite the fact that maybe there's no money, there's less time to rehearse, less day of rehearsals, so less. Let's rehearse 25 hours per day, you know, stuff like that. That a little bit, maybe on the Japanese side and the kamikaze.
But also the inspiration. You were trying to instill the inspiration with them.
And we achieved to very incredible results, I have to say.
Because yes, you
know, for example, for the temperaments, at a certain moment the group was playing with a Minton temperament. We were playing in Minton. We were playing 1/6 Minton temperament, straight. We were practicing the intonation. We were practicing the intonation like pigs. And I have recordings of concerts that you put on. It looks like a studio recording, literally. We were really practicing like, course, not everyone was happy about this maniacal way of playing. It's something that, I was looking for the entire time of my career, and rarely I could approach. I was trying to organize the group like a string quartet, normally.
And you had a vision for it.
Yeah.
And at what stage did Maxim Emelianishev get involved with you and the group?
When he was very young. I went to Moscow Conservatory, and he was the harpsichord accompanist. And we played also some chamber music together, and I discovered this young guy with this unbelievable talent.
Mm-hmm.
He's really breathing music. like no one else I ever seen in my life. Is he talks towards music. At the time, I think we had no common language because he had no English. I didn't speak. I don't speak still now Russian. And we were just communicating towards music, towards eyes. And he's such a genius. Maxim is really a genius. Really.
And you must have both been very excited to meet each other.
Yes, because when I found
recognition.
Yes, when I found this guy, I said, wow, this is the guy, the musician I was looking for in the entire my life. It's just living with it. So I remember the day after I met Maxim, I called immediately the manager of the Pomodoro, said, we must invite this guy. Absolutely. I know he's very young, but we must really invite him. And
And that was the keyboard he was playing.
He was playing the keyboard. Yeah, and then at a certain moment, when the amount of concerts was too big to deal with, I left at least a quarter of the activity of Pomodoro to him. Yes. We had also some... At the time, we were, between the manager and me, we were sharks in selling concerts. We were like, I don't know. Also because, you know, Giulio D'Alessio is from Napoli, is able really to sell refrigerators in Alaska. It's like, you know, it's, look, I sold two concerts on the same day. But Giulio, we can do that. Yeah, no problem. One is taking over by Maxim, one you do it, and then we organize a travel, no problem. Yes, he was fantastic. And
And when did you first start actually conducting opera? How did that happen?
I have to say, you must believe me. I am not doing for being coquette, but never wanted to be a conductor. Really, for real. I was always playing the violin. I had quite a huge activity as a concertmaster, invited concertmaster, guest concertmaster in the modern orchestras, symphonic orchestras. I had my first contract in Cagliari, in Sardinia, in the Ente Lirico when I was 19.
Wow.
I'm mostly known as an early player, just because I was maybe in the cover of the CDs, but I was always keeping a foot into the modern world, operatic world. And my experience of conducting was, you know, conducting from the violin, chamber music, the maximum I was doing at once was Dvorak Tchaikovsky Serenade from the violin that you can easily do, no? And or a Concerto Grosso by Corelli. And that was my experience as a conductor. And then at a certain moment, different conductors start to ask me to prepare the orchestras for them. You know, can you go there? Can you do the first two rehearsals? And then I'm joining, and I was passing then as a concertmaster. And I start to prepare orchestras for a bigger repertoire. So with a bigger wind section, brass, percussion, even larger string groups. And certain moment I found, wow. I remember the shock was in this festival in Knowlton in Canada. Where Kenta Nagano, I was the concertmaster with him, and he asked me to do two rehearsals. One was Eugenio Onegin by Tchaikovsky.
Wow.
Conducting Eugenio Onegin from the violin, it's impossible. You can't do it. It's
just, you know, even you.
No, the orchestration is utopic. And the first violins, the first violin's part is... you have to play the Paganini concerto constantly. You can't deal with what the second trombone is doing. It's really... your mind is occupied only to play those crazy passages. So, and then at the moment, in that rehearsal, remember, I put down my violin... And I started to do my Kung Fu Panda movements, trying to get the group together. And in that moment, I realized, I think I need some lesson. Yeah, the lesson of my solfege maestro are not enough. So I started to get a little more interested about the conducting thing. Also thinking, but only in this key, just because if I want to help the maestros that are inviting me as a concertmaster, as a preparator of the orchestras, I should have the tools to be able to do that, no? And then that was moving everything together in Canada, where I met also my wife there. She was singing there, and I was also a consultant, because I brought there to Nagano what was at the time the embryo of the critical edition of Norma by Bellini that they published for Bernard Reiter in 2016. And Kate, my wife, she was singing there Adalgisa in the opera. So,
is she Canadian, Kate?
No, she's American. She's from American. Maine. Yes. Okay, yeah. And so everything was together, the activity of the Pomodoro, meeting Kate, starting something like sort of conducting. And then some theaters started to ask me, people that was interested about what I was doing, was curious. I said, oh, let's see. I know, actually, I started to conduct some Handel operas from the violin. I'm still doing. I mean, before coming here, I was doing a Schoenstatt's opera. We were doing Agrippina, and I was conducting from the violin.
Oh, fantastic.
You can do it easily, Handel opera. Actually, it's better.
You've got a production where they're not too far upstage.
Yeah,
it
depends by the situation, of course. Yeah, we had the ensembles or stuff like that, of course. Maybe I'm hanging the violin on this music stand, and I'm moving my hands, waving a little bit. Yeah. So it started like that, and then bigger projects came out with a bigger repertoire, with a more modern repertoire. And the starting point was actually this ensemble with who I owe so much of my actual state, which is Ensemble Resonance in Hamburg.
Oh, yes, yeah.
It's a chamber orchestra. I think it's, in my opinion, it's one of the best chamber orchestras in the world. Mm. They are incredible. Mm-hmm. And they are really fanatic, really fanatic. Wow. Like we were with the Giardino Armonico back in the 90s. We recorded the Stabat Mater Pergolesi with them, with modern instruments.
Uh-huh.
We won 6 comma Minton, based on the flats, of course. I came there. It was the first time ever we played with the Italian repertoire of the early 18th century. We never did that. We did plenty of Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach. We did plenty of Mozart, Haydn, Beethoven, etc. Modern music, because also it's a group specialized in, focused a lot in contemporary music. Mm-hmm. Every project we do now, we have a season in Elbphilharmonie in Hamburg. We do always a new composition, a new piece in every program.
Wow.
And
so they're adventurous and trusting, and we'll go with whatever you want them to try.
No, they were crazy, because the first concert they asked me to conduct Prelude de l'après-midi d'enfant by Debussy.
Really?
I remember at the phone they said, are you sure? I never did that. No, I think it was Tommy. It was crazy.
Gosh.
Tommy, I love Tommy. Tommy was proposing me this. I said, okay, look, I can try, but I can't guarantee that it's going to work. And that was a little bit the A, you know. They gave me the A to say, maybe I can do that as well.
Mm.
And also, I don't know, I need always the new toy. You know what I mean?
We call it having a low boredom threshold, the British way of saying
yeah.
That.
Yeah, because it's stimulating me. If I'm doing something that I know I'm prepared, I'm trained to do, it's less exciting than doing something that is totally, something completely new.
So do you, to jump for a minute sideways, does that mean that doing a run of opera performances with the same people, the same production, do you have to, towards the end of the run, might you get a bit bored or be trying
No, of course, no, never. Especially if you are playing a masterpiece like Così fan tutte. It's music that is offering really on a silver plate in every bar, the possibility really to be so much immedesimate. It is this word?
Creative,
being really a deep part, we're having a really big connection with what the composer had in mind. And Mozart is such a creative person, he is able really to translate with a incredible gesture, with the most simple turning of an harmony, a theatrical gesture into reality, into materia.
To give a sort of perspective and depth to the words and yes. the situation.
Yeah.
So what was the first Mozart opera you ever conducted or directed and
What it was? I played many of them back in the first one I conducted ever, I think, was Don Giovanni.
Mm.
I did plenty of them. Actually, you know, I was made of the, let's say, I did, with, now with this Così, this is my first Così, and I was missing only Così and Zauberflöte. Uh-huh. I'm doing Zauberflöte next year in Amsterdam.
Oh, good.
So okay. I completed, I did Idomeneo, Don Giovanni, Nozze several times, Clemenza di Tito, etc. So.
I mean, from our perspective, it is fantastic to have a conductor for whom Italian is their first language to be doing an opera which is in Italian. You know, that doesn't happen with your, it hasn't happened so much with OAE, if ever, actually, that we've actually done a performance. Oh no, that's not true, because we had D'Antoni, that's not true, but we're doing Handel, but not with Mozart. We haven't had that.
I think it, no, I want to look a little bit, you know, how do you say, I don't know the word, but I think it could help, help.
I think also it because, definitely yeah. helps, because the way, just the recitatives, the way you pace it and how we phrase to go with the language and the way, you know, where to, because there's a certain way, this orchestra has performed Così quite a lot, as it happens, with lots of different conductors.
I can imagine.
But mostly they've been British. And for me personally, it's absolutely fantastic to have someone for who it just has the ebb and flow. And I think that goes as well. I think that's part of the tempo fluctuations, that you do that very naturally, like breathing, you know. And it is a bit of a shock to us in a way, in that we've never been asked to do that so much with Mozart. But it does make sense, and it's all, I think it's to do with the ebb and flow of the Italian language, which, you know, English and German are very much more measured and less...
Mozart was a German guy, eh? We don't have to forget this, eh? Maybe with the structure, but of course his basing is a composing technique on tools that were invented in Napoli. So it's a German composer talking Italian. And this is what is making his case so interesting, in my opinion, the fact that his music is remarkably Italian, but with a background that is really much more structured than other contemporaries of him. If you think about Iommelli, I don't know, the composer he got in contact when he went to Napoli, Iommelli, Cafaro, you know, those people like that, Ciccio De Maio, Francesco De Maio. But basically using, you know, those patterns. We were talking about that
talking about this book. Yes. Describe the book and say what?
Okay, it's a huge book. Basically, how can I resume in two words? This composing technique was called partimenti, which is something that, for example, without knowing it and calling it in another way, we were studying in conservatory in Rome. We were doing the bassi di armonia. So we are obliged to on a bass, only on a left hand movement, being able to understand how the harmonical procedure should be catching out this harmonic procedure hidden out from this baseline.
Okay,
so there are certain criteria, you know, that there's a certain movement of the baseline, and according to this movement, there are certain rules that you should follow for the condotta delle parti, how do you say, the direction of the lines, no?
Yes.
Soprano, alto, tenore, basso.
Yes.
It should move in a certain way.
Yes.
And those patterns, they had, well, probably they had a name at the time, we don't know. I mean, for some of them we know the names, for others this musicologist invented the name of them, but they basically, the composer of the time, and Mozart included, they were using those patterns in a very smart way. Now I have this harmonic procedure, then attached to this I put this other standard, then attached to that another standard. Now I have my aria.
Wow. Nice.
You know?
Yeah.
And so it's both observing the form, and on the other side is a very quick way to write music. Because that was
the formula.
Yeah, there are formulas, exactly. Mm-hmm. So you follow this path and you are sure that you are coming after a couple of hours with a wonderful aria. And of course, then there are composers that are more able than others to create amazing things. The talent of Mozart, of course, are the melodic verve is absolutely astonishing. And but it's così, I think it's especially all the entire Da Ponte cycle is offering a lot of possibilities. Is music really written for the scenic movement? For the scenical scene, for the scene of the opera on stage. Mm. Think about the quintetto of the Addio in the first act.
Yes.
No?
Yes.
For every figure in the plot, there's a certain music written for it.
Yes.
So when you see that and you play just strictly in tempo, with the same tempo, of course, you have an unitarity. At the same time, you lack the contrast and the theatrical action and the theatrical timing, you know? Because there are figures that, for example, Ferrando and Guglielmo are totally somehow, let's say, figuring out to be destroyed for their departure. The two ladies are extremely worried and anxious, and Alfonso is laughing under his moustache. So we have really these three words that are so clearly written in the score. This is one case among billions that you can see in this score.
So it's a very good example.
So if you do everything at the same time and the same tempo, okay, maybe what I'm doing is something related to the later 19th century tradition that maybe started with Wagner. Wagner was reading, you know, the Schindler essay about Beethoven. Schindler invented so many fake news about it, but he was trying to have this change of tempi all the time. It's a tradition that was kept until Mengelberg or even Richard Strauss. If you hear the recording of Mozart by Richard Strauss, of the Beethoven recording of Richard Strauss, Furtwängler, for example, also the change of tempi. Mengelberg is incredible what he does with the tempo with Gonzaga Orchestra. It's incredible. There's not a single bar with the same tempo. But we have also earlier sources that are talking about this elasticity. Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach, for instance, he's talking about solo music. Okay, in orchestral music, we have maybe more sources talking badly about the conductors that were changing constantly the tempo. If you think about Spohr, for example. Or Mendelssohn, but we have other cases of people that were listening to the operas, for example, by Salieri, or by Piccini, by all the Kur composer in Vienna, in the Burgtheater, or Gluck, for example, and we know that the conductors, the first violins there, were able to carry on the orchestras and having rubato according to what the singers were doing on the scene, so it's not so unrealistic. I think it's possible, but somehow it's not my goal to reproduce exactly what was done 300 years ago. No, also because it's utopic, you can't say that, and we don't know. I'm just trying to, we heard this music, we were saying the other day in the rehearsal, in tempo for 75 years. I think the heritage of Arnon Kurt, what Arnon Kurt was trying to show up, another side, another layer of readings.
And because the rhetoric of the whole thing.
Of course.
Thing.
And,
really and
everything is in the score. Everything is in the score. It's very clear for me. And maybe I underline for somebody's too much. Normally for the journalist, I'm the too much guy, you know? Too forte,
well,
too fast.
You're Italian, you're very strong personality, you have a big imagination and very unusual ideas. And I mean, everybody has to be shocked once, don't they?
I think the parameters about what is a piece of art and what is not are very confusing nowadays. We are living in an era of the subjective point of view, no? So it's always my word against yours. No? What's the point? Where is coming the constructive discussion about it? Why are you not trying to recreate an objective point of view where it can be very exciting? I would accept, of course, one of those journalists that wrote so badly about my performances in the past, having a constructive discussion about this. Because you can say, okay, I don't like what Minazzi does. Perfect, good, give me a reason, let's talk about it. Not, I don't like it because I don't like it. What's the point?
Yes, not? You'd think they'd want to find out what drives you to do that and where you're coming from and what you think about
it. I was surprised that those journalists, I was really underestimating them. I was really surprised that they noticed that we were changing the tempi. They were saying, this box-shaped overture with the change of tempi every two bars. Oh, you noticed it. Okay.
I don't understand box-shaped anyway. Yeah, so what does that mean in this context?
In one sense, yes, it's true, because there are different patterns, different partimenti. So one box is like that, one box should be like that. It's true. Actually, it's a good. I will use in the next rehearsal, the box shape. I love it. And there are many... At the end, I'm not inventing anything. I'm trying just to underline things that are in the score. I have a beautiful face. I'm trying to add mascara, lipstick, in order to make those colors or those features really more visible from far away. Just that. It's nothing esoteric, I think.
But, you've studied the score, and you bring with it all your research and your knowledge. Study the score, and now you're just reacting to it emotionally as well, aren't you? I mean, that's really...
And obviously, it's being out, if you take in account also the historical sources, okay, and with you guys it's so easy because you can go really far away in this. You can really combine the things. But also you have to be realistic and pragmatic. For example, you know what is my biggest frustration of this così? Is the fact that there's not enough... differentiation in the tempi between the Descrivermi ogni giorno, the quintet and the first act, and Suave sia il vento. Are two andantes, one is in four, one is in alla breve.
Yes.
So do you remember the first rehearsal I said, I will try to have a really, because according to Leopold Mozart, the tempo alla breve should be the double. Of the tempo in four. Okay, maybe we can be a little more elastic, of course, but I was trying to have a real remarkable difference, but the singers, they were watching me like, are you crazy or what? So they insist, of course, they have their reasons, of course, they should shine there on stage. We are in the darkness of the pit, so who cares about us? But they have all these long phrases, especially in the first one. So Fior di Ligi was asking me, no, can we speed up a little bit, please? And on the other side, Suave sia il vento, no, but we want, we heard this piece. This lovely song played very slowly and so nice. Of course, it's beautiful music, so we want to enjoy every drop of it. So at the end, we end up having basically the same tempo. I mean, it's fine. I mean, Mozart, unfortunately, is dead. At the end of the day, I'm feeling somehow guilty. Can you believe that?
No.
Yes, I'm feeling that I'm not doing a good service for this. I mean...
Well, you tried. I mean, there's...
We tried, yes.
Yes, you tried. I mean... I don't know. It's interesting, isn't it, that you don't always choose the people that you work with. You're put in this situation, and I don't know. I would imagine that you have to really like, or at least feel comfortable with, an orchestra in order to make music with them. I mean, particularly for the singers with a run of an opera. It must be impossible if you feel there's any antagonism or resistance coming.
Also, because I'm a guest, like they are. It's not that I'm the big boss and they are, on my feet. It's not like that. No. We were invited, we were called by the board of the company at the same time.
Yes.
So we are colleagues, and everyone has his needs. We have to deal that. We have to find a compromise, of course. Well,
you do, but you have, because your mother was a singer, and because you're an instrumentalist as well. I mean, you have got a foot in all sorts of camps, so you can empathise with how it feels to be in the pit and how it feels maybe to be on the stage and things like that.
I'm living now a moment in my life where I'm very happy that I was lucky enough to meet orchestras, including you guys, where that you were allowing me to, how do you say, to be my underpants in front of the music. You know what I mean?
To be in your underpants,
no, not in. No,
I thought you said to be your underpants.
No, no, in.
I know what I mean. What to be, does
to,
he mean?
To, no, to be, I don't know.
to cover up your intimate
Yeah, no, to be extremely vulnerable in front of the museum, in front of the magnificence of a masterpiece like that. It really, we have special moments, I think, the other day. Per Pietà, for example, the aria of Fiordiligi in the second act, where there's this moment where there's a sort of paralysis.
Yes.
I stop conducting. Mm. It's just, you are there, you are just contemplating these two bars that are present from the sky.
Yes.
And you know, and sometimes, I don't make any name, but I had experiences where when I was there, but you see what's going to happen here in the score? Have you seen my S3? Talking with the orchestra, the colleagues, and they were looking, yeah, whatever. You want piano? You want crescendo? Diminuendo? Oh. What? You can't translate that. Come on. It's just, you have to feel it in your skin, in your bones. And with you guys, it's possible to do that. And so I can really being in my underpants in front of you without feeling that you're going to do
No, not at all. You know what I mean? No, you've got us with you.
And everyone is in underpants in that moment.
Yes. And actually, from our point of view, what's nice is because you behave to us like one of us in a way, and you brought your violin to the rehearsals and demonstrated some phrasing on your own violin and to the singers as well, and that was so refreshing for us as well. And if you like something someone's done, or if you've asked them to do it, you react, which is so lovely, because often conductors just tell us to do things and you're trying very hard to do what they want, even if it's not what you think should happen, and then they don't give you any feedback afterwards whether you succeeded or not. So, but with you, it's not like that at all. It is like chamber music, actually. It does feel like that.
You know, I was sitting in an orchestra until the day before yesterday, so I know exactly what you are talking about. Yes, with the conductors, they're coming there and they're not explaining the reason for why he wants this or that. This is one of the reasons for why, for example, I never provide material with my marks and with crescendo, diminuendo, accent, staccato, legato, whatever. Mm-hmm. I prefer to don't do that. And maybe sometimes you need that if you have just a little amount of rehearsals or conditions that are not ideal conditions, that like the ones we are having here. But it's better to, because I'm convinced when you have sensitive person, musicians in front of you, you explain, you know, the reason for why I would like to go so far with this musical idea is because, I don't know, in the scene is going to happen this and that and that and that. I'm sure everyone will understand immediately the purpose of a certain choice. And we can even discuss. We said, okay, but why not being on the like that? Exactly the opposite. Ah, that's also possible.
Mm. The fact that you trust us, and when we were rehearsing, you didn't feel if someone had split a note or done something that you had to go back and cover it. You know when something like something is worth stopping to tune really carefully and balance. You save your battles for really important things, but you trust us as well, and we really respond to that. So anyway, I mean, so far we're absolutely loving it, and it's absolutely great, and it's so lovely to hear your thoughts about everything as well. So I'm going to really remember that in the next performance.
Thank you so much.
Thank you,
really. Nelly. Thank you.